Mr. Prada, you're back for another round. You're getting overtime today? At least that's the hope. Okay, our last case today is number 20-14721, Luz Elena Myers versus the Attorney General.
May it please the court. As the Fifth and the Ninth Circuit have held, an undisputed statement that is inherently not unbelievable and which is without evidentiary flaw should be taken as true and sufficient in cases of regular mail. In this case, the DHS never contested the facts of the statement. In fact, the IJ accepted it as true.
But the immigration judge, or the immigration law, as I understand it, in matter of MRA, states, quote, immigration judges are neither required to deny reopening if exactly such evidence, like the affidavits you're talking about, is not provided, nor obligated to grant a motion, even if every type of evidence is submitted.
We believe that MRA applies in a situation where the presumption of delivery already applies and you're seeking to rebut the presumption.
Why wouldn't the presumption of receipt apply here?
Because under matter of GYR, the presumption cannot arise unless you are given the warning.
So let's talk about that. Matter of GYR is an appeal from what?
It's an appeal from an immigration judge terminating proceedings, but it has been used.
What is an appeal from?
From an immigration order terminating proceedings where the respondent in that case did not appear.
It's a direct appeal from the denial of the government's request for in absentia removal, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Which statute, immigration statute, is that under?
The regulations allow any party to appeal. I think it's one.
I understand that. Which statute is that under? In other words, the government asking for and getting an in absentia removal has a statute with elements required. Which statute is that?
That would be 1229A(b)(5).
Big A, right?
Yes. Consequences for failure to appear.
Okay. In MRA, the one I quoted to you, that comes from a different statute, correct?
My understanding, that's for the motion to rescind.
Right, motion to rescind. So what is there? Is that the same statute, or is there a different subsection that governs the elements for a motion to rescind?
They're different statutes, but they all work in tandem together.
So how can an appeal from a discretionary call under one statute be the same as the granting or denial of in absentia relief as a matter of law in another statute? How could they be the same thing?
Well, I don't think there's discretion that an IJ can decline to go in absentia.
Right. It's not. That's exactly right. It's a matter of law.
Yes.
Is rescinding or in a motion to reopen, is that a discretionary call?
No, I don't believe so either.
Don't we review that for an abuse of discretion? Haven't we explicitly said
that? Motions to reopen are reviewed for the abuse of discretion generally, but if a motion to reopen presents an issue of law, that's reviewed de novo within the abuse of discretion.
Let's go back to my other question. A motion to rescind, a motion to reopen rescinding the in absentia order, that's under a separate statute. Which statute is that?
That would be BC.
So 1229A, BC, big C, little 2?
Yes, upon a motion to reopen filed at any time, if you can show that you did not receive notice in accordance with paragraph 1 or 2 of 239A1, right. 1229A.
So MRA, as I understand it, just to separate them, GYR is an appeal from a B5A denial, and then MRA is an appeal from the denial of a motion to reopen under B5C little 2, correct?
Yes, and I believe they work in tandem, right? Because to do the motion to rescind, you must show you did not receive notice in accordance with 1229A1, which is what we're actually arguing here, because A1F, he did not give the warning.
Well, so, but A1, as you know, GYR says A1F notice is different than A1A notice. In other words, you agree with me that it's proper to send notice to the last known address that is in the immigration court files, correct?
Yes, but okay. But to send notice is different from whether a default judgment.
I agree completely. Okay. You're 100% right on that. But we're not at the point of the default judgment. You're right that if it was sent there and not received, the default judgment likely should not have been entered. But we're in the point at which it was entered, and we're seeking to remove it.
Yes.
So if you agree with me that notice is proper to send it to the last known address, then why wouldn't the presumption of receipt, where it says exactly that, where as long as it's sent to a proper address, there's a presumption of receipt, and the question for the immigration judge is whether that presumption has been overcome.
I would say that notice is proper to initiate the removal proceeding. And then there's additional notice of A1F to go default judgment. So if this motion to rescind is granted, that doesn't mean that the proceedings are terminated. The proceedings will continue.
I agree. But my point is whether to grant the rescinding so that the proceedings continue or not. The only question, as you pointed out, is was notice sent pursuant to A1, 1229A1? And if it's proper, as you pointed out, and I appreciate that you did, you're right, if it's proper to send it to the last known address, and it was sent here to the last known address, and we know it wasn't not received because we don't have evidence that it was returned, unlike GYR, then how can we say that MRA is not exactly the analytical framework to apply that the IJ in fact applied here?
Two responses, and the first kind of response to an earlier question. So to rescind, it says you need to show that there was not notice under 1229A1, which has subsections A through G. So within, if you did not get the A1F notice, it still fits within the framework of the motion to rescind. And we believe that statutes are viewed in the whole, right? Not the provisions are not viewed in isolation. These all work together, and the canons of construction suggest that they should work together.
This isn't a matter of interpretation, though. I agree, you're completely right as to you read them in interpretation, but this isn't a matter of interpretation. What you've asked us to do is to say GYR governs this case, and to the extent it's inconsistent with Dominguez, we need to, the immigration judge needed to apply GYR, and the immigration courts and BYA are wrong for not doing so. But it seems to me that the issue in GYR was very different. The issue there is what is an A1F notice? And there it was clear on what an A1F notice is. But that's separate from the question of what authority must the district court have to rescind it once it's in place. And that's under a different statute with a different standard that is interpreted by different case law. Do you agree with that?
I don't think there's a conflict there, because to rescind, you have to show you didn't receive notice in A1. Now, that doesn't mean that you never received all of the notices in A1. For example, let's say the time and date was incomplete. The Fifth and the Ninth Circuit say that the rescissions, that's not the issue in this case, and I know it's been argued in this court in another case, but just as an example. So when we're saying that we seek to rescind because I did not receive notice under A1F, that's still I did not receive notice under A1 because A1F is subsumed within A1. Yeah,
but that's not the question that MRA. MRA didn't even mention A1F. MRA says the question is, did notice go through the proper channels? I think it's the properly addressed and mailed according to normal office procedures.
Exactly. It was sent to the right address. It was sent to an address that counts as an A1F address.
Okay, so we agree. You and I agree on that.
Yeah, so GYR is an issue that must be met or resolved prior to MRA. So they're in steps. The first question is, did we send it to the right place? That's GYR. MRA is, we sent it to the right place, but there's a failure of delivery.
The problem is GYR is not asking that question. GYR asks a separate question, is what is the proper notice to give a proper address? If you don't show up, to interpret or apply a presumption that you got it correct and we can give an abstention order. But GYR, both factually and legally, is very different. Factually, it's different because we knew for a fact that they didn't receive it because the mailing had been returned. And as a matter of law, it's different because it's interpreting the language of A1F. MRA doesn't say anything about A1F.
There's multiple questions there. So the fact that the mail was returned in GYR was because it was certified mail. So that's automatic. We're talking about regular mail here.
No, that's not a proper reading of GYR. Counsel, that's just not a fair reading. Let me go through what was specifically said by GYR, by the court in GYR. The court said there, quote, "We understand from the service's brief that the respondent did not receive the notice because it was returned to the service by the Postal Service. Again, we also know that the respondent did not receive the notice because the certified mailing was returned." In other words, it was returned as not there. Further, this case, however, does not involve actual notice. Rather, it involves constructive notice in the form of undelivered, and there's an emphasis there, not mine, undelivered written notice. Further, In short, the notice requirement leading to an in abstention order cannot be satisfied by mailing the notice to appear to the last known address of the alien, again, emphasis theirs, when the alien does not receive the mailing.
Okay, right.
Also has the language, which, and that's what I'm trying to make sense of, is that you can't use the last known address provided theory unless the alien has been given notice that he or she has to update that address, right?
Yes, and that also includes, for example, if an immigrant is arrested and in being served with an NTA, they must provide an address at that very moment. And if they fail to, then they don't have a right to notice by mail later.
Or if they seek any other sort of relief from the agency, and in so doing, they're given a form that tells them it's your responsibility to update your address, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you might be put on general notice that you've got to tell the service when you're moving.
So if USCIS on its forms and in its instructions gave the warnings in A1F, I think that at that point we would not have an argument, but that is not the reality. USCIS has never done that. Okay, so the only time a person can be given the A1F warnings is in the process of being put in proceedings. So many times USCIS, for example, will mail it to the address. We're talking about mailing it many years after the fact here, when the person hasn't been given the warnings. And the thing is, Section 1305, it has its own consequences. One, 1306 says that it's a misdemeanor to fail to comply. But additionally, there's a ground of deportability for failure to comply with 1305. But that doesn't mean it's an automatic deportation by default. So when we're talking about the penalties that the statute gives for these two different address obligations, they give different penalties. So the 1305, just in disparate inclusion, the 1305 penalties cannot produce an in absentia default order. So we believe that and I'm running out of time, but I believe the BIA's construction is the only plausible construction because as they stated, you cannot give the address under A1F unless you've been told of your need to do so.
Okay, Mr. Prada, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Insegna.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Andrew Nsinga on behalf of the Attorney General. What this discussion reveals is there is a distinction between an MRIA-type claim and a GYR-type claim. The agency did not abuse its discretion in denying the MRIA-type claim that was actually raised before it. Now, petitioner wants to now raise the undeniably more complicated issue that's more about a matter of a Nielo issue of how do these 1305 notice requirements that you update your address intersect with the A1F, 1229A-A1F. The difficulty is if you want the agency to address this, then petitioner had to raise this issue.
Well, counsel, I can tell you, and I will speak only for myself, I don't see how it's not preserved here. I mean, this seems to be the classic. They've raised the argument. They may not have raised it in exactly the right way, but certainly the immigration judge understood this, which is the point of preservation, to have something with GYR related, since the immigration judge cited GYR below in its order, and that was discussed at the BIA level. So I think your best argument to me is not preservation. So
I understand, but I think does need to point out when an immigration judge cited GYR, it's for the general concept of notice. So the difficulty is we have, as I think the prior discussion reflects, the difficult intersection of when someone like petitioner files a 485, and this was the DHS's decision here, our argument. When petitioner filed their immigrant visa, the 485 application told her you must update your address. Now that was with CIS that you have to update your address. But of course that's where ICE, the immigration arm, would get the address because they're both part of DHS. So petitioner provided this address to DHS overall, was told you must update it under 1305.
Counsel, here's what it seems to me. If we were here in the same context that GYR was, I think I would agree with the petitioner. In other words, if we were in the position where we were reviewing the denial or grant of an in absentia order, I think I would agree that to do an in abstention order where there was no actual notice, where it was constructive, you would need to be warned under the A1F framework, absent law from us and absent a claim that we shouldn't give Chevron deference and other stuff. But just applying GYR, that would seem to be right. But we're not in that land. Right. The abstention order has existed since 2013. We are in a separate statute in a separate land where we're reviewing the question of under what authority does the IJ or the BIA or the service or the government have to rescind that order. And there, MRA seems to suggest to me, and this is where I'm trying to ask you the same questions I asked your opposing counsel, which is once you send proper notice, and everyone agrees here that proper notice is using the last known address, whether it's an A1F last known address or not, once that's done, there's a presumption. And then there are factors that are considered by the immigration judge to see whether that presumption is overcome. Have I stated anything incorrect so far?
As far as I can tell, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because
so is that discretionary decision is what we're reviewing, is it not?
Yes, the discretionary denial of a motion to reopen, yes, to emphasize.
Why is that decision correct or not correct?
Well, as Your Honor and now petitioners conceded, it was sent to the last known address. There is no other way for DHS to obtain an address from a petitioner who has provided their address to DHS other than go through the records and say, here's the address we have. We know that she provided it to DHS. We know that she had a legal obligation to update it. DHS sent it to the last known address. And petitioner has now conceded that was the proper address to send it to.
Well, I think they've conceded it is a proper.
It's a proper.
But it would not be sufficient to have an in abstention order. I think that's their position.
Under A1F. But again, we are talking about a motion to reopen an in absentia removal order. It deals more with overcoming that presumption of delivery. And when.
Actually, a presumption of receipt, isn't it?
Receipt, yes. Actually, and that's a good point, Your Honor. It's a presumption of receipt, not merely of delivery. And what this court's, again, this court decision is unpublished, but Chi Hu Sun is exactly on point, factually and legally. It came out after GYR. It came out after Matter Nielo and obviously Dominguez. And so what it said is when the post office doesn't return the mail, as we all know that the post office will return as undeliverable, or maybe they would have forwarded it if the petitioner had done at least provided her address to the post office, not to say that that's necessarily would have been sufficient. But what we know in Chi Hu Sun is that it wasn't returned as delivered, and the court said, well, then that emphasizes the presumption of receipt applies. This is exactly the same case with almost the exact same timing. The timing between the petitioner and Chi Hu Sun applying for LPR status and then the NTA being sent was 4 years. Look, it's exactly the same timing.
Forget rules of precedent for the moment and forget deference and everything else. Dominguez is wrong in how it describes some of these statutes, right?
I'm not sure exactly how they would be wrong.
If it's not wrong, tell me why it's not wrong. So well, Dominguez paints with a very broad brush. It seems to me that its description is less than absolutely accurate in the exact language those use. In other words, it says an in abstention order can be granted as long as there was proper notice. That seems to not necessarily be consistent with A1F, right?
Correct. I think this is why we talk about the preservation issue being matter, is that this is more, you know, to focus on what would be sort of an unexhausted claim. If petitioner wanted to resolve that complexity, I'm not saying, because the Attorney General can't say Dominguez is wrong absent a more complex issue here, but the saying 1305 necessarily is a reserve adequate for A1F, there's a lot more complexity there. So I don't want to say the court was wrong, but there's just greater complexity here. And when you say, for example, Department of Homeland Security is attempting to argue, well, the 45 application does tell you to update your address for 1305 and trying to say, well, that's adequate for a presumption of receipt, or, and I don't want to put words in DHS's mouth because maybe they would want to argue in an actual and in absentia order case. I don't know. If we really want to try to resolve that complexity of Dominguez and that would have to be raised to the agency of how that interacts. And If petitioner wants to say that the AG should say Dominguez is incorrect, that's fine. She was allowed to raise that issue.
Tell me why you think that GYR is inapplicable, if it is, in these circumstances. Or do you think that GYR is applicable, but that Ms. Myers loses under the analysis in that decision?
Well, I think as we've had this discussion, petitioner loses because she's failed to, under the motion to reopen requirements, rebut the presumption of delivery or receipt. And that is a related issue, but it is a distinct issue. Now, if petitioner wants to go under on a different theory, this is where the preservation issue gets more complicated, because GYR is in absentia, but Aniello is a motion to reopen. As Chihusun points out, and the government concedes, there's tension in these cases. And this is why when a litigant goes to the agency, it behooves them to be clear about what they're asking for.
Is there a way to shift for a minute? And I'm speaking with a very broad brush here. So is there a way to read Dominguez as being more, and it doesn't get to your ultimate point, but in trying to figure out this tension, is there a way to read Dominguez as being more concerned with a due process constitutional notice problem and reading GYR as dealing more with what the statutory framework requires in a given circumstance?
That is seemingly how the board found in Matter of Aniello. It said it looked like Dominguez was focused on the due process claim. But the difficulty is then Chihusun sort of undermines that suggestion.
Well, let me just tag along to the question that Judge Jordan asked. When he asked about statutory framework, in which you agree, we're talking about the statutory framework for entering an in absentia order, correct? That's what you're agreeing with.
Right. So that when GYR is focused on that in absentia removal order, and Dominguez is focused on the motion to reopen, that's where this complexity requires presenting this to the agency and saying there is this complexity, acknowledging it, instead of trying to sort of brush it aside and just say MRA and say we're done.
My question is actually a little, I mean, Judge Luck's point is well taken, but my question was actually a little broader. In other words, regardless of what statutory provisions GYR was concerned with, my question is whether or not you can read Dominguez as being a constitutional floor due process case, and you can read GYR, whatever it may mean within its four corners, as a statutory notice case.
Correct. That is what Matter of Aniello said.
Well, right. I'm asking you, I didn't cite the case name to you, but I'm wondering if you think that that is a valid way of distinguishing them. Whatever GYR may mean on its own terms, that they are not necessarily inconsistent because they're dealing with notice in different sorts of worlds. One is constitutional and one is statutory.
That is, I think, a fair reading. That is how the board is looking at it as a matter of Aniello. But
are you familiar with an unpublished and non-precedential decision by the BIA in Chiron?
I think that's the first case that comes up in Westlaw, Your Honor. Yes.
And what do you make? I know it's non-precedential. I know it's not binding. I know all of that stuff. But what do you make of that? How do you think that fits into the rubric? You think it's just wrong? You think it's distinguishable? You think it's right on its facts?
I think it's irrelevant. The difficulty, and often people want to come using unpublished decisions. The difficulty a little bit is how much information do they provide? One fact, and I think I do remember this case, one fact that the board starts their paragraph is taking into consideration the petitioner's age. They talk about his age, and I believe the same case we're talking about. Age is not relevant for notice. In fact, the difficulty is because that decision is not meant to be precedential, it actually looks like it is sua sponte reopening the case. Now, I can't put words in the board's mouth because this is an unpublished case.
In other words, it's not a subsection 2, it's not a little 2 case, which deals with not sua sponte reopening, but a statutory basis to reopen.
Right. So it's subsection 2 being upon a motion to reopen filed any time if the alien demonstrates that the alien did not receive notice. But then the board is talking about...
I want to make sure we're talking about the same decision.
Correct.
Non-precedential as it is. I don't think there's one talking about the age of the respondent in that case.
Well, I
don't know if we're talking about the same one, and I don't want to box you into a description of a case that we may be talking at cross purposes about.
Correct. All I can go through is it was like matter of Chowdhury or something.
No, this is In Re Cherie Leslie Charon.
Charon.
It's 2019 BIA, and it says at the very top, this is an unpublished decision, not intended for citation as precedent. So I understand that perfectly well, but if you don't remember it, then don't worry about it. I don't want to make you talk about a case that I'm describing to you for the first time.
I believe perhaps it is different. The one I was thinking of is, I believe, something along the lines of Chowdhury, and it wasn't a subsection 2 case.
Okay.
Counsel, can you go back? You were going to finish off about Hui Hong Sun and how I think you were going to say something that it sort of contradicts it merges those two notices or the distinction between Dominguez and GYR?
Well, I think Chi Hoo-sun is trying to resolve to the best it can that tension without agency input on this issue a little bit. And that is to say that if we are in a motion reopen world, which we currently are, then that we're talking about whether or not petitioner can, under Little 2, rebut the presumption of delivery or receipt. And one of the things that the court really found relevant was the post office didn't return the mail. And obviously, if the mail is returned, that would suggest to the agency, there's a problem here. It would emphasize to DHS that there's a problem, so they could do something to remedy the issue if they could find petitioner. I don't know. But DHS has no reason to question when they send out the NTA, it's not received. And then the immigration court would have a reason to question, there might be a problem here when they issue the in absentia removal order. But now, again, we're back in motion reopen land where you have to rebut the presumption of delivery or receipt. And here, where the post office didn't return the mail, that is a factor to be considered. Now, petitioner leans heavily on, you have to believe everything I say in my affidavit. That's just not correct anymore. I mean, particularly more recently, I don't believe it's cited, my apologies, but the Supreme Court has emphasized that such rules in Ming Dai are not really
specifically rejected the Ninth Circuit's rule for that.
Correct, Your Honor. So we'd ask that the court deny the petition.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I have 3 points. The board has never held that MRA displaces GYR. Neither of those cases are in question. And we believe there are for different situations. For example, in the Franco case, Ninth Circuit unpublished, it does cite a Singh case. It says that the presumption of delivery does not include a presumption that the address is correct, right? And additionally, in GYR.
We know as a matter of statute, it's correct. As a matter of statute, you're allowed to send to the last known.
In order to initiate proceedings.
That's right.
But not for the purposes of going for an absentia.
So. Right, but we're not, the absentia's done. It was done 9 years ago. We're talking about what authority the court has to take out and to reopen so that it can rescind.
Yes, yeah, so the rescission provision, right? It specifically says if there was a failure of notice under A1, which includes many reasons of a failure of notice, including the A1F obligations were not given. So that never was given in this case because the petitioner never received the NTA. So we believe that we meet those.
If it meets one of the provisions, then it was properly given. Not that it failed to, probably didn't meet provision 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Well, in the Pareda and in these Chavez cases, the Supreme Court just said to be given notice under A1, you need to be given notice of everything. So if any one part of that notice is missing, you haven't been given that notice.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. But there is no, as you pointed out earlier, there's no allegation that the date or the time or anything else is not missing from that.
No, we're saying that the A1F warning of your requirement that you will be removed in absentia was not given because the petitioner never received the NTA.
Right, but that only matters for entering the in absentia order. You may be right that it should never have been given, but that's a separate question from whether the BIA exercised its authority properly to rescind.
Well, the motion to rescind is the remedy for that error. So the motion to rescind is written broadly. I think it includes other errors, but it specifically includes the A1F error because A1F is within A1. And the thing is, the practice in the immigration courts is that matter of GYR gets cases reopened. I know it's not in the record, but I personally have cases where I've reopened cases. I understand, but maybe in Westlaw these decisions can be found. I did not do the research, and I apologize for that. But this motion to rescind provision is the remedy for an improper in absentia order. So GYR, yes, it had a specific procedural posture, but that case is not about the posture.
It is. It clearly is the right remedy that you sought. That's not the question. The question is, can you overcome the presumption of receipt? So there's a presumption that your client actually received this. And the question is, was there evidence presented sufficient to overcome that presumption? And do we find that the BIA was, or the immigration judge was, arbitrary and capricious in concluding that it had not been overcome?
In GYR, the board held that the constructive service is sufficient if it comports with the statutory expectations as well as the due process.
That's for purposes of entering the order, not for purposes of overcoming the presumption, the rebuttable presumption, correct?
Well, the presumption doesn't arise unless the notice was sent to the right place. So if they sent the notice and the person was actually there and actually received it, it becomes an A1F address.
It actually says properly addressed and normal course. That's what MRA says. Properly addressed is to an A1 address, which is the last
one. But I would think that MRA is going on the presumption that the person already had the A1F warnings. Because MRA is, you're trying to rebut a presumption. You're saying that you sent it to the right place, but I didn't get it because maybe the post office had a mistake or what have you, right? But that's not what we're arguing here. We're saying they sent it to the wrong place, and sure, let's assume it actually got there. But I wasn't there because it was the wrong place.
But again, the presumption isn't a presumption of delivery. It's a presumption of receipt. Your client received it.
I don't think so.
That's what MRA says. I mean, you can not think it, but I'll give you a site if you'd like.
Well, the statute for rescission doesn't require to overcome a presumption of receipt. The statute for rescission only says that you did not receive the notice under A1 or 2. And in this case, we've shown we have not received the notice under A1, specifically with regard to A1F.
So page 673 of MRA.
I agree. I believe you. But the statute, separate and apart from MRA, the statute says, if you did not receive the notice under A1, your case should be rescinded. We did not receive the notice under A1.
Okay, Mr. Prada, thank you very much. Mr. Insegna, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
That constitutes our calendar for today. So.